Accession number 30143, reel 12.
And thankfully no one hit. And I think that's when we came across a Scottish unit that had just been hit, we believe, at that location with RPGs. So we might have just been, if we'd have known, we might have been able to follow up. But we had a different task, so we weren't allowed to stop. We had the commander of the British Army to look after. So, yeah, but different adventures. Not quite as scary, because you knew you had the backup, and you knew you could call in helicopters, and it was beginning to dawn on me how stupid I was first time, not letting anyone know, and yeah. So, yes, fascinating. Yes, got away with it, survived it, which I think we all thought. And it's an odd, I think, it was unspoken, but we all sort of resigned ourselves. Well, if you get injured, you get injured. If you get killed, you get killed. There's nothing you can do, so let's make the most of it. But it's very good. I think we're one of the first TA units to go out as a whole company. So it was great for us. It was like a big adventure with lots of friends. So it gelled us together.
Yeah, when you're training, you know, all this time with the TA, I suppose getting into using your skills.
It was nice to actually use it. Yes.
Yes,
like a firefighter learning to fight fires, but never fighting a fire. So
yes,
you sort of want to know how you'd react in a firefight, but quite happy you don't have to.
Yes, and I suppose you get a sense with the men, do you? A team.
Situation. Three guys in my vehicle, all from Kentish Town, so all sort of quite good friends. Well, very good friends.
Yes.
Yes, so completely gelled and know how each other works. And yes, this becomes nice to work with.
This is the end of reel 11. So this is reel 2, Matthew Cook.
Yes, and it was back to London, really, after another adventure. I found it... I got straight back into work quite quickly. You have a post-operational tour leave, which I think was about a month and a half of still on army pay, so I could have just taken a holiday, but I just got down to work. Which I think was quite good, so I just made myself busy.
It's interesting to know, would you have lost out by this 6 months away financially?
Yes, I did, yes. Yes, the army, it's got easier and better now, but certainly being freelance, the army just doesn't calculate that people are self-employed. And I was very scared about work taking another 5 months to build up clients again, but... Yes, I lost out. They try and match your outgoings, which is quite fair. So I managed to... So in army pay, I think I was on a major's pay. But... so it matched... I could pay my mortgage and be quite relaxed about the home bills. In hindsight, it was quite good that I was married, because there was another... I can't remember how much a month for my wife, just for living and... separation allowance and all sorts of things. At least here there was a network with other wives, some TA soldiers' wives, which has sparked up some new friendships, which has been quite good. And I'd have to speak to her, but I think she found this less hard to cope with, even though I was away for longer. I think that hit both of us. It was 6 months is a long time, and all I had was 1 week's leave, and mine was right towards the end, so that's just how it happens. Whereas the 2 months I was away before, it was completely into the unknown. Every time I phoned my wife, there was an air raid siren, so I had to either run, or there was gunfire or something. So she just got this impression of just a crackle of gunfire whenever I called her. So yeah, I think she gets the bad deal of it. Soon after I got back, we went on our honeymoon. This was 9 months after we got married, and we went to Australia for about 3 weeks, and I took her to an uninhabited island off the Queensland coast, which was just rainforest, and yeah, we had a lovely time, even though we're camping, but she loved it. We had to carry our own food and things, so that was a nice wind down, actually. But some colleagues of mine, I know some started drinking a lot more, and different people reacted different ways. We became a very tight-knit unit at the TA, post-conflict, and I'm sure we bored everyone else to death with some tales, but I couldn't really talk to my wife about it. I just didn't think she was interested. Mum and dad and brother, I never really said much about. My dad was more interested, wanted to see the photos and the drawings. But my mum wasn't that interested. I feel a bit... I never really took them into account of how terrifying it must have been for them, and I think they've been very good and never really said how worried they were, so it's probably a bit selfish of me in hindsight. And I think, like me, they're probably not sure what to... I don't think they're particularly for the war, but I think they're quite proud that I went out and did my bit. It feels like doing my national service bit or something, and managed to get some drawings out of it as well. Very strange coming back to London. This really strange... Whenever I heard an explosion or a bang... I would always assume that it was a bomb. I was not scared, not in a scared way. I'd go, oh, there was a bomb about 300 metres away. But it was just a boom for some reason. So that was a bit strange. And I really missed not having my rifle. We've got an optical sight, and it becomes such a second habit. Well, one, you've always got the rifle with you, and obviously desert and looking over such large distances, if you want to see what a vehicle is or even read a number plate or see what someone is, you're always looking into your rifle sight. And it was one of the odd things of coming back to London. It's like, oh, what's that? Oh, I haven't got my rifle. So it was very strange. I had a few nightmares about mortar attacks and my mum and dad coming under mortar fire, but beyond that, there was no touch wood, no harm done. But yes, I had a reasonably good time. I know some of the other people who were injured in a bomb blast. I think we had about 5 serious injuries out there. One was a road traffic accident where the guy broke his neck. And you don't think about all the non-military, non-enemy action injuries. And that's changed me now. Having seen this friend lose an eye, it's always just a post-paragraph, oh, and 3 more were injured. But, well, that's lifetime. Thankfully, he took out all the maximum insurance he could, and sort of he was lucky, but obviously got no depth perception. So it was quite moving. And it's only about now that I think about Iraq less and less. I can feel it getting behind me a bit, whereas literally for... So 2 years, it was always there, every day, every hour, something would remind me, or a thought, or just daydreaming, it would crop up. In 2005, I was working towards an exhibition. I sort of picked this date almost a sort of year after, and I managed to get sponsorship from the Times to half sponsor it. So this... Maybe that's why I was sort of thinking about the conflicts. I was still working on the drawing, so it was in the background all the time. So weekends, evenings, I was trying to work on this catalogue, and the exhibition proved very successful. I sold sort of almost 90% of the paintings. I just wasn't quite sure how it would be taken, whether I'd get a brick through the window from an anti-war protester, or people were interested, but people came off the street and were just curious, just thought, oh, that sounds interesting. And a lot of the people invited were people I'd met from the first tour, from the Irish Guards, the Black Watch, the Royal Horse Artillery. So it was great meeting some of them. A lot of them left the army, and they were interested to hear what Basra was like and what the palace was like now. And conversely, people from my operational tour, so the helicopter wing commander, and it was very successful, my own commanding officer and things. And this led on to a rather unexpected route. There was a colonel from they're called the RGBWLI, otherwise known as the Alphabet Regiment, so it's the Royal Gloucester Berkshire Wiltshire Light Infantry, who thankfully this year have amalgamated into the Rifles, so it's much easier. Now they were doing their last operational tour as the RGBW, so the unit I was in, the Green Jackets, we've become the Rifles as well, so it's this massive amalgamation, losing all the county regiments. And he knew this was coming, and this was his, they're quite a big deal to take command of your battalion on an operational tour, and he knew it was the last one under that cap badge. And he saw my drawings, I think, just prior to the exhibition, so I invited him along. And he said, Matthew, how do you fancy coming out to Afghanistan for weeks or months to come and draw my battalion? So I did. Yes, without even a pause. What a great follow-on. Just a superb, what an opportunity. The plan A was to get me mobilised as a TA soldier individually to go out there. I think when it came to the exhibition, the battalion had literally just deployed either days or weeks before. So I was already into that 6 months. They're only out there for 6 months. And the deployment proved tricky. I think the training major at my TA just kept stopping the paperwork going up to the MOD, because he thought, as I'm a corporal, a section commander, he thought, no, once you're out there, they'll just spam you for doing guard duty and doing this and that, and you know, you won't be able to do your drawings, which is a fair point. It would have been a bit of a weird me tagging on with the colonel. Anyway, this literally went on for 3 or 4 months, this toing and froing, and it got to a point where I did have dates to go up to Chilwell to do a brief sort of mobilisation, and I was going to get deployed, which meant I'd have been paid by the army, which is a bit cheeky of the RGBW. It meant that I'd have got paid and they wouldn't have had to, they could have relaxed a bit. It was a complete unknown, never been done before, so a complete mystery. No one knew what was going on. It was all scuppered at the 11th hour by my adjutant, who was sort of handling it. Had a personal drama and was taken off, you know, wasn't working anymore. Where it's a stand-in adjutant, fitted in and took up the paperwork mid-route, and he was speaking to someone in the Ministry of Defence and said, anyway, about the war artist. And up till then, war artist hadn't been mentioned. I was purely going to be a soldier that they needed for whatever. They would have come up with something. So as soon as he said that, what war artist? And as soon as he said that, apparently it was discussed, it went up to a really high level up in the MOD, but someone said, no way, it's costs or whatever, we're not sending someone out just to go and draw. So it got stopped in the end. So, yeah, after all of that, and they only had sort of 2 or 3 months left in theatre, so this was such a... Obviously I was working, but you know, I had my heart set on it. It was such a nice job to be able to do. Eventually, going through media ops, I managed to get access out there, and they said, oh, that's great, if a regiment actually wants you to be with them. Normally it's, you know, the media trying to get in touch with the regiments, but they're saying that's fine if they want you out there and they're willing to feed you. Yeah, and they said, well, media normally stay out there for a week, and I just kept quiet, so I said, okay. And so I said, yeah, I'll probably be there for a week. But chatting to the colonel, I said, I'll probably need a month, because they had this huge, vast, you know, the area of, I think it was the size of Wales to cover. So they covered northern Afghanistan, Kabul, and down in Helmand, so literally a whole area. Obviously amongst other ISAF troops, but there were very few British troops out there at the time. And obviously with so much travel, I thought the longer out there, the better. So somehow managed to convince a wife that it would be a good idea for me to go out. And she was pregnant just before I left, so I knew about this, but I was out there and I missed the first scan and things, so I was a bit in the doghouse. But yes, it proved fascinating. It was quite a different... I've now learnt you can't really compare any of these trips. They are all so different, I suppose, every conflict and conflict area. So this was still in a peace support role, so it was, and there's obviously lots of evidence of the war from 2001, so it felt quite different. You know, all the tank hulks were all very rusty and had been chopped up for scrap metal, so it felt like the war had been quite a time ago. Certainly wasn't the rattle of gunfire, and you know, it was nothing like Basra. I think at this stage the casualties had been very few. The RGBW had taken, I think, at least two killed at this time. So it was still going on, still ambushes. And this was the mobilisation just before 16 Air Assault went in, and had them all, you know, the media scrum that followed them. So the media were just beginning to pick up. So some of the trips I would go to were up in the north in Mazar-e Sharif. We had a couple of meetings with the elders, with the colonel and then the brigadier, and I would sit in on these and just take photos and sketches while we're all eating food, which was wonderful. And then the press pack would be allowed to come in, and they wouldn't take their boots off, they'd walk on the carpets. They did, okay, maybe they hadn't been briefed, but they did some real faux pas, and they would greet the wrong person. You know, we knew whose house it was, who was sponsoring the Shura, the meeting of the elders. He was obviously very proud, and you can see him crestfallen when, you know, the Channel 4 news guy goes and shakes the hand of someone else and goes, "Thank you for a wonderful meal." You could see him, that's like my house. Oh, it was embarrassing. And then they're asking all these elders about the opium and the Al-Qaeda down in the south, and thankfully the elders are going, "Well, I know much about it as you do. I watch the television and that's all I know. I live up here, I've never been down there." So they were asking some really stupid questions. Anyway, it was good once they left and we could get on with it, because obviously the army, that, well, they'd been out there for quite a long time, so they knew. And likewise, I was sort of, I soon sussed it out just by sitting and watching who the owner was and how proud he is looking. So I made sure I took more photos and sketches of him than other people, and he loved it. And so it doesn't take long, I think this was even the first day I was out there, so it doesn't take long to pick up on these things. But yeah, the media just bulldozed through it. It was a bit embarrassing. And they were forgetting their helmets and leaving equipment. And anyway, so the troops were a bit scathing of them. But up in the north, the media disappeared again. So, you know, the bomb blasts, there were IEDs, improvised explosive devices, and car bombs found, and they'd lost one guy and five injured a month before in Mazar-e Sharif. But because the media weren't there, all it got was a tiny sort of half line in the newspapers. You know, everyone was thinking about Helmand at this stage, so it was a bit sad, but it was far more dangerous than that, those few weeks up in the north. And I joined in with some mobile observation teams, known as MOT teams, and they would drive these, again, Pajero four-wheel drives that I'd hired in Iraq, and I'd go into the mountains and just meet with the local villages and just try and look for projects, and if people need, if a bridge was down or an arms cache, or they're being hassled by Al-Qaeda or fighters, are there mines? It's just a bit of an intelligence gathering, and also just to get sort of face of the military out there. So it's a bit of liaison really, but what a wonderful job driving around these mountains. And it was such compared to Iraq, which really was bare-assed flat desert ingrained with plastic water bottles and rubbish and litter and oil. And this was stunning mountains and crisp air, and the people looked amazing. And again, everyone just amazed to see you and waving. Some people quite scared, but if you got out into the streets, it sort of come up to you eventually. And Kabul was fascinating. I absolutely loved it. And lots of foot patrols. I knew that I was only there. I didn't have a finite date, but I sort of stretched it out for a month. I'd tag on to every patrol. Some days I'd go out on three or four patrols, I'd be absolutely shattered, you know, from a nighttime vehicle checkpoint, and then on a sort of 10 kilometre foot patrol, and then another nighttime patrol. I'd just to try and see and do everything. I knew that these opportunities happened so rarely.
What was Kabul like, though? Hadn't it been damaged a lot?
Yes, some of it was absolutely complete ruins, and which again, just a draw, is wonderful. They had made houses out of the shipping containers. Shipping containers follow the army wherever they go. Obviously, the equipment gets shipped out there, and obviously the Americans being out there, there are thousands of them. They make up the perimeter of most British bases wherever we're deployed, be it Bosnia or Iraq or Afghanistan. So shipping containers are just part of the army. And obviously the locals, being very smart, adopted them into shops. You know, you wanted to lock everything up, so but also built mud walls around them, so someone's house might be a shipping container, but they'll have cut a door out and it'll go into a courtyard, and just very ingenious. Allegedly Kabul had been cleared of mines, you know, a few months before the Halo Trust said, right, Kabul area is now clear, but there were still patches that were unexploded ordnance, and it was all marked with blue and white stones meant unexploded ordnance. So there's still lots of old tanks and ruins, and if you came across these blue and white stones, if you remained on the white side, you were fine. The blue side meant that it was unexploded. And same as red and white stones, white side meant there were no mines, the red side meant you were in a minefield. So we saw those further south and further north, but not in Kabul.
This would have been before the big deployment.
It was just before the 5,000 went out, yes. So there's probably 1,000 British troops out. And we flew with the colonel down to Helmand, huge airbase, American airbase in Kandahar, and we were flown by Chinook into Lashkargah. Yes, Lashkargah, which is the capital of Helmand. It was an American base where we were staying. They were still building Camp Bastion at the time, which is where the British are based now. That's right out in the middle of nowhere to give it as much security, so there wasn't much point in going to see it. But went on lots of patrols around Lashkargah. I think the day after I left, there was a car bomb at the gate, which again, I think, killed one of the RGBW, so they had a few casualties on their tour. So it was obviously building up, and this was just as the poppy eradication thing started, which, to be honest, I haven't heard of since. It started off with this great gusto, and I remember the Afghan National Army being deployed, but then while we were out there, we heard that their convoy had got bogged down because it was quite wet at the time. They hadn't been resupplied with food, so the troops hadn't eaten for about a week, and they were just sort of abandoned out where the vehicles had all bogged down. They'd only cleared about a couple of hectares of poppy fields, and that was it. They had to come back rather shamefaced, going, well, that was the first first trial. But what a tough country to operate in, just logistics and people, and yeah, very strange. And for most of that, I was actually wearing uniform. The colonel was quite happy. He issued me some kit and said, come, might as well blend in with the guys. So that sort of blurred the edges again. It was just a lot of the troops there were going, well, you are me, or what are you? So I'd just say, no, I'm just doing some drawings. And they printed a lot of the drawings in there. They had quite a flash magazine, an end of tour magazine, and printed a lot of the drawings in that, and one on the cover, so they give them quite a spread. And I'm still working on them, so that's still ongoing phase. Who knows if there might be an exhibition at the National Army Museum, so we will see. But again, sponsorship is needed, and this would probably be in 2008, so I need quite a lead time again.
I can imagine the people would be rather beautiful, you know, the clothing, the hats that the men wear, and the burqas of the women. Were most of the women in burqas, did you find?
Yes,
or covered?
Yes, certainly in Kabul, it's still that pale blue burqa. And I remember asking some of the translators, why is everything... Most people's front doors were pale blue. It's just pale blue cropped up a lot, or sort of cobalt blue. And they could never answer. I thought it might be some sort of Islamic colour or something, but I was curious. It was interesting chatting to the translators about times under the Taliban, because it's almost more... Maybe I didn't ask Iraqis what it was like under Saddam, but I remember some of them were telling us about Basra when it came under artillery fire from Iran, which you never realised. But yes, to hear it from them saying no, we couldn't fly kites, couldn't play music, it was just, what a shock. And nearly all of them fled to Pakistan and then came back, learned English and came back sort of a few years later, or after the American invasion.
So your output, would these be landscapes and war scenes as well,
Yes, a lot of it's the British troops patrolling. The National Army Museum have bought 7 or 8 of them.
So similar to the your sort of
it is a bit, yes. A lot of them all too familiar.
but different locations.
Yes, different locations and
wonderful
different
countryside. Were you able to depict that, the mountain?
I haven't yet, but I've just got a mountain of work to work on. Unfortunately, I've been swamped with work normally, so
yes,
that's been good.
Am I taking up
no,
my
no.
time? Well, the exhibition will be fascinating, I think.
Well, I hope it happens. It'll happen in some form, even if it's a low budget one. But
yes, and of course, Afghanistan is becoming more and more important, isn't it?
Yes, and my regiment that I'm in the TA with, it literally got mobilised for Afghanistan last week, so I've ducked out of this one, which is a bit frustrating, but yeah, they're going to be off to Helmand, and obviously casualties are coming quite high. Again, not as high as Iraq still, but Iraq's still worse.
Mm.
And Basra's sort of more gun battles and things, and it's got even worse. Should I mention North Korea as a by the by?
Yes, it's interesting that you did get into North Korea, and
yes.
There's a similarity with Iraq, I think, makes it more relevant, doesn't it?
Yes, in a way. I know it's, and it's one of the another axis of evil.
Mm.
It was a job for Condé Nast, the American travel magazine, and I think it was, I went there probably last summer. This was a couple of months after coming back from Afghanistan. It was last July, in fact, a year ago. And I think it was just after, they must have had some weapons trials, but somehow, or nuclear testing, some reason Americans weren't allowed in. So Condé Nast wanted to do a travel piece, but obviously couldn't really send an American in. And generally it's no photography, so they came up with the idea of having a British illustrator. I'm not quite sure how they found me or how that worked. Not quite sure. But I went through a couple of British expats who live in Beijing who sort of run tours into North Korea. So this job had been mentioned sort of some months before, and then it wasn't going to happen. And then I got a call, this sounds all too familiar, about a week before, saying, what are you doing next week? Can you come to North Korea? So suddenly having built up, completely disappointed that it's not happening, and then not mentioning it to anyone, and then a week to go, and yeah, I don't think I had time to get a Chinese visa, and it turned into a bit of a nightmare to actually get out there. But what a weird trip. I had to remove any sort of military, take the army batteries out of my camera, and no army day sacks or anything, and a bit of a shock just turning up. They literally check every book that you carry. We're obviously not allowed to take any foreign books, so guidebooks that they would look at were fine, but no reading material. You leave your mobile at the airport to be picked up on the way out. Literally search all your equipment. Thankfully my passport did have a stamp from Iraq and Afghanistan, but I don't think they really read the English, so hopefully wasn't noticed. I was quite scared about that. But once we were in, it was a bit more relaxed. So for I spent about 10 days there, and the bulk of it was going round with this group, which was a mixture of sort of Irish, Canadian, one Americans crept in under a sort of Canadian passport, and it was for the 35th anniversary of the Korean War. So obviously their side, it was the victory, the Great Fatherland victory over the United States. So it was fascinating seeing it from that side. It was very restrictive on what I could draw. The last few days it was just myself and the minder, sounds a bit harsh, but our guide, and he would literally tell me what I could and couldn't draw. I'd ask, can I draw the railway station? And he'd go, no, the army use a railway station. Okay, can I draw those people? No, they're building something for the army. So it was quite frustrating. We stayed on a rather grand hotel, I can't remember the name of it, a sort of triangular tower block in the middle of an island in the middle of Pyongyang, which we weren't allowed off. So it's like the Alcatraz of fun, we called it. Had a bowling alley underground, and you just have to pinch yourself where you were.
This is End of Reel 12, Matthew Cook.